I hope the next hour or so, we have about an hour, and then the time we have for question and answer. And Charles, I think you just took my notes.
Oh, gosh.
At the bottom there.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Would you like these?
Thank you very much. It'll give us an opportunity to interact on some very crucial issues that are facing the church. And it's something that I've written about in The Next Evangelicalism, but trying to understand what is going on in the church. And I write as an evangelical, as someone who is kind of steeped in the evangelical tradition. I'll give you a little bit about my background. I was born in Korea, came to the United States, and we lived in a pretty rough inner city Baltimore neighborhood for a number of years. A third of our community was poor black, a third of our community was poor white, and a third of our community was recent Korean immigrants. So none of us got along. It was a kind of a very tough neighborhood. I drove back there a few years ago just to see, okay, what kind of neighborhood did I grow up in? And I got a little scared, and saying, driving through my old neighborhood. And then when you're a kid, you don't think about those things, except that right after elementary school would let out, we would run through the graveyard that was next to our apartment complex, and we would run as fast as we could, because if you walked around the graveyard, it took like 30 minutes, but you could walk through the graveyard in like 5 minutes, but it was also where all the beatdowns occurred. So we would run as fast as we could through that neighborhood. I grew up in a single-parent home. My dad had left our family, and my mom was trying to raise four kids as an immigrant, someone who barely spoke English, trying to raise four kids in a tough inner-city neighborhood. She worked 12 hours a day at a carryout in Baltimore, and then she would go work a night shift at a inner-city nursing home. And she did that 6 days a week, and on the seventh day, she took the Sabbath and was certain to take her children to church. And so that was kind of the context. She worked very hard in order to get us out of the inner city neighborhood and moved us to almost the exact opposite extreme, which was a neighborhood called Columbia, Maryland. And if you know anything about Columbia, it is actually a quintessential suburb. It was a planned community right between Baltimore and Washington, and intended and designed to be intentionally multi-ethnic, but also this kind of ideal, perfect utopian suburb. And it really is a very wonderful neighborhood. My family still lives in that community and area. But that's the context that I grew up in. I had grown up for most of early elementary school and junior high school in an inner city neighborhood, and then part of junior high school and high school in a suburban neighborhood. That kind of led me to try to look for ways that I could be an urban pastor, but integrating both of these worlds. The comfort and affluence of the suburbs, as well as the urban poor that I was one of, and trying to integrate the two together. So after I graduated from seminary, I went to seminary in Gordon-Conwell, and then I did a THM at Harvard Div School. After I graduated, I finished that graduate work. I planted a church in the Cambridge area, Cambridge Community Fellowship Church, and I was a church planter in that area for about 10 years. And when we started that church, we were actually one of the very few churches. In fact, we might have been only the second church that was an intentionally multi-ethnic church. This was 1996, so not that long ago, but it was there was one other church in the city of Boston called Dorchester Temple, which was an intentional urban multi-ethnic community, and we were probably the second intentionally multi-ethnic community. And so one of the few churches that really focused on this issue of racial reconciliation, and our inspiration for this was John Perkins. And the writings of John Perkins, the sermons that we had heard, he was really a key element of the formation of our understanding of the call for the church to be involved in racial reconciliation and racial justice. In fact, one of the highlights of my ministry in Cambridge, and this is, it's kind of ironic that I actually wasn't there when John Perkins visited our church. I was on sabbatical for about 6 months. I had gotten a Lilly Foundation grant. By the way, if any of you are pastors, at about the 7-year mark, go to www.clergyrenewal.org. And the Lilly Foundation can give you anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 a year to take a sabbatical. Please apply for that and get that money. It's there. You just need to apply for it and try to get it. Well, our church happened to have received that grant. I was away on sabbatical, and that's actually when John Perkins visited. So I lament that, but I got a copy of the tape, and I've listened to it at least once a year to try to continue to get inspiration. I wrote the book and reflected on some of the things about urban ministry, and especially the topic of racial reconciliation, because of my journey steeped in evangelical subculture. My identity is as an evangelical. I grew up in a Korean immigrant church, but our theology and even what we aspired to was very much evangelical subculture. The books that we would read, the Sunday school material that we would use, were coming from the Southern Baptist Convention. We're coming from Zondervan. We're coming from these evangelical publications and publishers. And nobody on those pictures that they had looked like anything like us, right? I mean, the pictures and the covers of the books, the pictures and the covers of the curriculum looked nothing like the Korean immigrant church that I grew up in, but it was a part of our embracing of Christianity was embracing an evangelical, American evangelical subculture. I grew up in an American education system, and especially the evangelical expressions within that system. I was very actively involved with InterVarsity. I was also a campus minister for a number of years with InterVarsity at MIT. Went through Gordon Conwell, and so you can. And I teach now at an evangelical seminary, training future evangelical pastors. I've planted evangelical churches and been a part of evangelical systems and structures and organizations, committees and denominations for as long as I can remember. I've been steeped in this system of evangelical culture. Yet, at the end of the day, there are still times that I feel marginalized and left out of evangelicalism. And when you say the word evangelical, you don't picture me. In fact, very recently there was an article on Newsweek. How many of you saw this article? I think did it say decline or death or demise? One of those three words that was doom, death, demise, decline of Christianity. And the opening paragraph was fascinating because they were talking to Al Mohler, who's the president of the Southwestern Baptist Seminary. And Mohler was talking about was this lamenting this horrible decline of evangelicalism. And especially pointing to what was happening in New England as this snapshot of why Christianity was in such sharp decline. And we've seen a lot of articles like this. I think there was another article in Christian Science Monitor. There was a book called The American Church in Crisis, written actually by a friend of mine, Dave Olson. And a lot of these books have very similar themes. In fact, if you read a lot of the emerging church books, or if you read a lot of the books that have come out more recently, they're lamenting and really decrying the loss and decline of evangelicalism. Now, what they mean by evangelicalism is a particular brand of evangelicalism. Because if Professor Sanders and myself were to decline evangelicalism, we might define it differently than the way Time Magazine defines it, the way Newsweek defines it, the way Christianity defines it. Because when Time Magazine, Newsweek, or Christianity Today defines evangelicals, they mean white evangelicals. They mean a specific subculture of white evangelicals that is not only a spiritual, theological designation, but it is also a political designation. So in that sense, even though I am steeped in evangelicalism, I oftentimes feel left out of the category of evangelical. In my mind, the evangelical is someone who takes the Bible seriously and believes in Jesus and wants to live by what Jesus says in the Bible. That, to me, is an evangelical. But in our social context, we often think of evangelicals as white Anglo-Saxon Protestants living in an affluent Chicago suburb. So that becomes the picture of evangelical. So we're getting a lot of this lamenting, this hand-wringing about how, oh, we're seeing this decline of evangelicals. There was a Pew report, as well as, I believe it was called the Eris Report, American Religious something. Anybody remember the name? It came out about 3 weeks ago. And both of these reports, the Pew Report and the Eris Report, said essentially the same thing, and it was lamenting the decline of evangelicalism in the United States. And one of the things they pointed to is that the percentage of those who were spiritual but unaffiliated rose from 8% to 16% in a matter of 15 years. And it had doubled in number. Now, that number is really focused on white evangelicals who are increasingly disgruntled with the politicizing of evangelicalism. So what you're seeing is more and more white evangelicals leaving the church in very significant numbers. What we're not accounting for, and this was my major gripe with the Pew Foundation report, the Pew Foundation did a study of about 50,000 religious affiliation, trying to find a religious affiliation of about 50,000. They did what they called a representative sampling. The problem with the representative sampling is that you are having some preconceived notions about who gets represented. So, for example, the Pew Foundation's created a category of evangelicals, and then created a category of black churches, as if the two had different theologies or a different God or a different religion altogether. When if you look at the evangelical doctrine, there's a lot of similarities in terms of theology with the historical black church. Went to and said, all right, let's look at the Indian population, Southeast Asian, South Asian Indian population, and said 100% of those representative sampling were Hindus. Well, that's actually not the case. Not 100% of Indians in the United States are Hindus. And they looked at the Middle Eastern population and said, well, 100% is probably Arabic. Actually, that's not true. The second largest group among the Arabic population is Christian, and it's actually not as far off as you would think. You would think, well, it's 99% Christian and 1% Christian. It's actually, I think the last number I saw was 40% Arabs are Muslim, but about 30 to 35% are Christian. In fact, the most fun I remember from a recent retreat that I spoke at was an Arabic evangelical church. Amazing, amazing group. They start worshiping at 11 o'clock at night and don't stop till 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, it says on the schedule, you know, the program starts at 9 p.m., so I show up at 9 p.m., and I'm sitting there. There's nobody there. And about 2 hours later, I've been sitting there praying, and then 2 hours later, everybody starts showing, oh, yeah, it's time for the service now. The big problem was that we were doing this during the World Cup, and that was a major, major mistake to try to do an immigrant church's retreat during the World Cup. So what we're seeing is that there is a preconceived notion about what is evangelical, and that's why I really thought this title was both ironic and amusing, that it is a white evangelical expression, this idea of reconciliation. But the word white and evangelical has become synonymous in many ways. So I want to try to redefine evangelicalism first of all, and then talk about what does this mean for racial reconciliation, that third R of racial reconciliation. So again, we're seeing this perceived decline of Christianity in America. And Moeller, in this article in Newsweek, begins by lamenting the decline of Christianity, particularly in New England. And he makes this a major point. We knew the Pacific Northwest was always decadent and secular and evil and all of that, but we thought New England had some rich theological, historical, Anglo-Christian roots. And it does. Jonathan Edwards, Moody was saved there. You get all this kind of rich American Christian heritage in New England. And so Moeller is lamenting this decline of Christianity in New England. Now, here's the irony of this. Most people hearing that from Moeller would say, yeah, of course, New England is a very secularized region of the country. It is humanistic. It is, in fact, when I was a pastor in Cambridge, it was almost a yearly ritual. We would get a group of very concerned evangelicals from the South and the Midwest, from California. They would drive up. This was their summer project to come and pray for the lost souls of Cambridge, especially Harvard University. I don't know why, but they said, we need to pray for the downfall of Harvard University because they're producing all these liberals that are changing our culture, and so we need to go, and they would do Jericho prayers around Harvard University and pray for the downfall. And I'm seeing this, and I'm saying my church is about, you know, 50 to 60% Asian American, and you know, you're going against our culture here. For an Asian to get to Harvard is the Holy Grail, and you're not being very sensitive if you're praying for the downfall of Harvard. That's inappropriate. But there is this perception of New England and Boston as a spiritually dead place. In fact, I remember when I was moving up to Boston after having grown up in the D.C. area, D.C. Baltimore area, being very afraid because my church and my pastor had said, you know, don't lose your faith in Boston. It's a spiritually dead place. Have you heard this perception before? Yeah. Boston is a, New England is spiritually dead. Again, Moeller kind of amplified this. Now, when I got to Boston, I found it actually the complete opposite to be the case. I found Boston to be spiritually vibrant and very much lively. In the opening part of passage of my book, I talk about going up to this church building, and it's this beautiful historic church building, but it had been completely gutted out. And they had left the corner of that wall, but behind it, they had gutted out and built this high-rise condo. Classic gentrification. But what they had done is they'd taken this church building and said, oh yeah, it's a historic place, so let's preserve the wall, but we can gut everything outside and make a condo out of it. But that's a very very sharp image for me to think about the decline of the Anglo churches, and especially like mainline churches, and even some evangelical churches in the city. What we're seeing then is not in Boston, was not the decline of Christianity in Boston. It was the decline of white Christianity in Boston. So that the white churches were in very, very sharp decline. But what you were seeing were ethnic minority, immigrant, and multi-ethnic churches absolutely flourishing in the city of Boston. I have some statistics here in the intro that I have for you. Between the year 2000 and 2005, Boston was one of the five states, was in the top five states out of the 50 that had the greatest attendance increase of all churches. So 28 out of 50 churches, there was attendance decline in churches. Boston was in the top five in terms of church growth, in terms of attendance. In 1970, the city of Boston was home to about 200 churches. In the year 2000, when the study was done again, there were 412 churches. So there was a gain of 212 churches. But actually, of those 200 churches, half of those churches had closed their doors. And those were the white churches that became condos, art centers, community centers, and the like. And they've shut their doors. The United Church of Christ that had been vibrant 100 years ago, they were now an empty shell of a building. The ABC Church, the PCUSA Church, the UMC Church, they've shut their doors, or they're down to 5 to 10 people meeting in a back room. Elderly, women, kind of huddled together in the back room because they can't afford to pay the heat in the main sanctuary that at one point had housed 1,000 people. So what happened was that those 200 churches in 1970, half of those no longer exist. But there was a net gain of 300 to 350 new churches planted in a 30-year time period. Now, if you have 300 new churches planted in a 30-year time period in a city the size of Boston, Boston is only about 500,000 people. The city itself is relatively small. That's not spiritual death. That's ridiculous revival. In fact, there was another study done between 2001 and 2006. So this is even after those 412 churches were found in 2000. In a six-year time period, 2001-2006, 98 new churches were planted in the city of Boston. Again, if you have 98 new church plants in a six-year time period, that's not spiritual death. That's phenomenal growth. So the follow-up study was, we want to ask you, how many of you have an English, a language service other than English? And 76 of those 98 churches responded, and more than half of them have said, yeah, we have a language other than English. My guess is that number goes higher because the other 22 churches didn't respond because they asked the question in English. So they didn't respond because they were speaking in a different language. So we're talking about the overwhelming majority of new church plants in the city of Boston are with a language other than English. Now, that even doesn't account for African-American churches, doesn't account for Asian-American churches that have a very strong English congregation component to them or are English-speaking. It doesn't count for multi-ethnic churches. So to put it in a nutshell, what we're seeing in American evangelicalism is a transformative moment. Boston is just the microcosm of it. You see it in Chicago. You see it in almost every major city. The white churches are in sharp decline. But the ethnic minority churches, the immigrant churches, and the multi-ethnic churches are flourishing. Another example of this is I was at a workshop, or actually a consultation, on immigration a few years ago in Washington, D.C., and one of the people that was there was someone from a mid-sized evangelical denomination. And what he said was, if you look at our numbers, we look like this. We've kind of flatlined, maybe a little bit of growth. Our evangelical denomination has not grown that much, but we haven't declined. If you look at the mainline churches, they're like this. They're in sharp, sharp decline. And mainline churches are worried. Mainline churches are talking about evangelism. They're writing books about evangelism. They're talking about going out and saving souls. This is a transformative moment in church history. But they're still in this very sharp decline. Evangelical churches have kind of flatlined. Now, what he said was but if you push us on our figures, and you take out the ethnic minority and immigrant churches from our statistics, our numbers look just as bad as those mainline churches. So what is sustaining evangelicalism in the United States? It's not the white churches. It is the growth of immigrant churches, multi-ethnic churches, and ethnic minority churches. This is something that hasn't really been recognized yet. It's been recognized globally. Jenkins's work, Sane's work, Andrew Walz's work have recognized that global Christianity has clearly shifted from a majority white, 80% white in the year 1900. By the year 2050, we're looking at 80% non-white of the world's Christian population will be non-white. So we know this on this larger scale, on the global scale. We haven't quite recognized this in the United States, the changing face of American evangelicals, what I call the next evangelicalism. Now, this means that this concept of reconciliation is now much more complex than it was 20, 30 years ago. Because we're not just talking about, well, we know, first of all, that by the year 2042, they keep changing these numbers, and whenever they change it, they move it closer and closer to the present time, that by the year 2042, the majority of Americans will be non-white. By the year 2023, so within a very short period of time, the majority of children in America will be non-white. What I'm saying is somewhere between 2023 and 2042, so before American society, the American church, the evangelical church in particular, will be majority non-white faster than society at large, which is probably the first time that the church has actually been ahead of the game. So that's another kind of momentous moment that we need to reflect on. With this change in demographic, we're seeing a much more diverse American evangelicalism. Now, what does this mean? What are some of the implications? And how do we deal with the issue of racial reconciliation given these changing demographics? Let me talk about two things, which are the two obstacles that I see to genuine biblical racial reconciliation. And I want to emphasize the biblical part. Genuine biblical racial reconciliation. I say this because there has been a lot of talk, and we've been alluding to this all along, post-election of Barack Obama, that we are now living in a post-racial America. Have you heard that phrase? We are now living in a post-racial America. Now, what's interesting to me is who makes that pronouncement, we are now living in a post-racial America. It's white people saying, all right, we are now living in a post-racial America. I'm sorry, you don't quite get to make that kind of statement because those who've been oppressed by a racist America are still saying, no, we're not living in a post-racial America. So that leads us to this understanding of power, the issue of power. Again, it's come up a number of different times. The power to define is the power that dominant culture has right now. And that hasn't changed simply because we've elected an African-American president. We still have the dominant culture defining this is the way things operate. I mean, yes, this is a momentous historical moment, and I went all the way with this thing on my school issue, laptop, computer. I put my sticker on there. I almost got into trouble, but I mean, my school is probably the only Christian school that would let me get away with this. But what we've seen is a very historical, momentous moment, but how many African-American senators do we have right now? One. And he's not going to be long for the Senate the way he got into office at this point of the game. We're talking about, we still have a very significant way to go. Now, I'm talking in larger secular culture, but I would say we have even further to go in American evangelicalism. So here's the irony and the contrast. American evangelicalism is going to become more multicultural faster than American society, but we are lagging further behind than American society when it comes to racial reconciliation, multi-ethnicity, and an understanding and appreciation of cultural diversity. And again, a big part of that is the power to define what the terms of this dialogue are. I'll say something about kind of American culture as a whole and then focus in on evangelicalism in terms of the power debate. One of the key ways this comes up is who gets to define what is an American? Now, you here in Charlottesville, you're good Americans, right? According to, never mind, the campaign's over. But, you know, there's the good Virginia, and then there's the not-so-good Virginia. There's the real America, and then there's the not-so-real America. Now, what that's alluding to is that there is a perception of there are good Americans, the Americans that we want to have lead us, and then there are these kind of, this kind of other America, the other America that's in the blue states, the other America that is concentrated in the urban centers. Some of this is seen in three different spheres. Let me backtrack a little bit. So when we talk about who gets to define America, for a very long period of time, the ones who got to define America were whites and only whites, because a precursor to citizenship was that you had to be white. A good book on this is by Ian Haney Lopez called White by Law. And if you've seen the PBS documentary, Race, the Power of an Illusion, there are some very powerful sections in there where they document Supreme Court cases where they kind of change their mind every 3 months and say 1 month, yeah, no, race is based upon scientific knowledge. And then 3 months later, they said, well, no, it's really based on common sense. And Lopez points out that there is no clear scientific way of deciding who is white and who is not. It has been determined by society. And the example of this is that there was a Japanese-American who applied for citizenship. He said, look at the color of my skin. I am whiter than many white people. And so common sense should tell you that I am white, therefore I deserve citizenship. He says on top of that, not only am I white, but race shouldn't matter. What should matter is I hold the values of America. I'm a Christian. I dress as a Westerner. I'm married to a white American. My children are biracial. I have American values. My creed, my way of looking at the world is American, and that should be what determines my citizenship, not the color of my skin. The court said, no, scientifically speaking, you are not white. You're an Asiatic person, so therefore you cannot have citizenship. Exactly 3 months later, another court case came up, and in this case, it was the case of an Indian American. And in his case, he said, I have scientific proof that I am white. Why? Because I come from the Caucasus Mountains. I am about as Caucasian as you can get because the Indian people come from the Caucasus Mountains. So scientific proof tells you that as an Indian, I am white. I am Caucasian. The Supreme Court said, no, actually, according to the laws, common sense tells us, even though scientifically you can claim that you're white, common sense tells us that you are not white. So in 3 months, the court went back and forth to determine how do you determine whiteness. Well, what it comes out then is that whiteness is determined by those who are white. So whiteness is determined by a white Supreme Court, by the white government, and so what you have is a determination or a fiat by the government saying this is how we determine whiteness. Now, I want you to keep in mind, again, the Hannaford has another good book on this, but Lopez, I thought, did a really good job of sketching this out. I want you to keep this in mind when you compare the way that Ozawa, the Japanese-American in the case, who said, make me an American not by the color of my skin, but based upon my values and my creed and my American culture that makes me more an American than the color of my skin. Sam Huntington, Harvard professor, writes in Who Are We? Pretty much the opposite of what Ozawa says. He says that American identity really should be determined by, he doesn't come out say this explicitly, but the implications are pretty clear. American identity is determined by white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture. And therefore, I don't think he uses this exact word, but the implications are pretty clear. This invasion of Hispanics and Mexicans and brown people is changing American society. And we can't adhere to a creed value system to determine who is an American. We have to determine it by the cultural norms of white society, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant society. So you see this in academia, where whiteness and Americanness is determined by whiteness. You see this in politics, where a presidential candidate by the name of Tancredo from Colorado, of all places, not even a border state, what's he talking about? Colorado, of all places, Tancredo, his entire presidential platform was on kind of these draconian immigration laws. That was his entire platform. He had no other gimmick to run on except to stop immigration reform. And then we also have another one-trick pony by the name of Lou Dobbs, who actually gets to pontificate on CNN his ridiculous views. And what we've got are these three areas of academia, of politics, and of media. And I hesitate to use the word news because I'm not sure that's what Dobbs is doing. But you have these three areas of media, politics, and academics where they're saying America needs to be defined by whiteness. I mean, if you boil it down, that's essentially what they're saying. And that's why, again, during the presidential election, it floored me how many people said Obama's not a real American, right? Why? Because he doesn't look like what a typical American is supposed to look like. In that, what we're seeing is who gets to define the norm? Who gets to define this is normative for our culture and society? Whiteness is normative, and everything else is around the fringes. And I transfer this concept now to evangelical theology and evangelicalism. And in evangelicalism, we also have the norm. So in American society, you say you're an American if you're white. In evangelicalism, you're saying you have power and privilege if you're white. Now again, is it explicit? Probably not. But is it implicit? Is it what we see in the world around us? I would say so. For example, evangelical theology. Evangelical theology puts at its center Western European thoughts and says, Calvin is normative. In fact, we don't call it anything else except this is theology. We don't call it European theology. We don't call it North American theology. We just say theology. We say that about Luther. We say that about Moody. We say that about all these, Jonathan Edwards. We say that about all these North American European theologians. We just call it theology. But as soon as theology comes from what you might say the margins or outside of that normative whiteness, you start giving it a name. Liberation theology. Black theology. Feminist theology, Minjung theology. So now by giving it this added name, you're saying that theology is not normative. Liberation theology is for those poor, oppressed folks in Latin America. Minjung theology is only for Koreans in Korea. Black theology is only for African Americans. That's not part of the norm. This is the center, and everything else, we give it a special name because it's not normative theology. And that's where evangelical theology moves to. Let me give you an example on this. I was at a conference a few years ago. Actually, no, it was not that long ago. And it was a conference preparing to go to Cape Town in 2010. You might have heard of something called the Lausanne Movement. Lausanne was a very central aspect of the formation of evangelicalism in the 20th century. Billy Graham, a lot of famous evangelicals were part of that thing. They're having this follow-up conference in Cape Town, 2010, following up to Lausanne. And they asked a group of pastors to get together to talk about what's our agenda for that gathering. About 200 pastors. It was an interesting format. They had three plenary sessions. They had someone from the third world. They had a Bolivian, a Nigerian, and someone from Hong Kong kind of present, and then they had someone from the U.S. present there right after. And in most cases, that worked because it was complimentary. It worked out well. In one of the cases, though, it just blew me away because you had a Bolivian kind of talking about his understanding of the gospel message being an understanding of the gospel that draws from community. It says, in Latin America, we understand the gospel through the lens of community. Well, that's important for a Bolivian. That's important for Latin America because the way the culture operates is very much in the context of community. Well, what happens is the very next person to come up happens to be an Anglo pastor from someplace, I won't mention where. He gets up there and he says, but you know, we know what the real gospel message is, don't we? We know what the real truth of the gospel is. Then he goes to proceed to talk about this excessively individualized, personalized gospel message, essentially discounting everything that has been said prior to that, saying, well, that's okay for those Bolivians to think that, but we know what the true gospel message is. I kind of walked away from that and said, unless some major changes occur, we're going to disgrace ourselves in Cape Town in a few years because we're going to come into this gathering. There's supposed to be about 5,000 participants, only 400 coming from the U.S. because that's the proportion right now of American Christians to the rest of the world. And we're going to go in there and say, but, you know, you guys are doing fun things in South Africa and Korea and in Latin America, but we know what the real gospel message is, don't we? We know what's normative. It is the Western theology that we have in front of us. So that's the difference of what is the norm. And what I'm challenging evangelicalism is, we can't enter into a reconciliation dialogue if there's already the assumption of this is what defines evangelicalism. To say evangelicalism is defined by this normative Western theology. Now, that spills over into church practice. Theology leads into sociology. Theology leads into ecclesiology. And one of the ways that I see this is that we are seeing a lot more people interested in multi-ethnic churches. And that's exciting, yet I'm the cynic in me says, I want to be careful where we're treading here with multi-ethnic churches. The reason for that for me is that when we started, it was not an easy thing because nobody was doing this kind of stuff. You know, even now, it's still not, there's not a whole lot of models, as our brothers were sharing with us earlier, there's not a whole lot of models out there. But, you know, their churches have been doing this for a long time, but at the same time, there are a lot more churches doing this now. My concern is that there isn't a theological depth to our reconciliation models. And what we're doing is we're playing the games of let's hold hands, sing kumbaya, and call that reconciliation without really dealing with the history, without really dealing with what's underneath the surface there. So I categorize it this way. There is now the colorblind approach to reconciliation, and then there is the racial reconciliation, racial justice approach. The colorblind approach says, if we all just get good Christians together, hold hands, sing the same songs, then we're reconciled. That's the way to do it. Just hold hands, sing together. Don't talk about our differences because we're all one in Christ. Don't talk about our cultural differences because when we get together, we have a new culture, and that new culture is the culture of Jesus, and we all love Jesus, don't we? And so that becomes the colorblind approach. The other approach, racial reconciliation approach, is much more difficult because now you got to deal with history. Now you got to deal with this normative theology that's in the middle of the room. It's a lot more complex versus the colorblind approach. Let me expand on that colorblind approach a little bit further. There have been two ways of looking at looking at American multi-ethnicity. How many of you remember that show, Schoolhouse Rock? Remember the Great American Melting Pot? Remember that? The Great American Melting Pot? Now, I don't remember the details of it, but the idea that they used to teach in elementary school was you get all these wonderful nationalities and flavors together, and you throw them in hot water, and you melt away all their flavors, and at the end of it comes out cream of mushroom. So what you're doing with the melting pot is saying, well, we're going to do away with the original culture and just melt it away and have this cream of mushroom soup. Now, the best response to this came from a Native American friend of mine and said, you know, we Native Americans, we don't melt very well, so don't quit trying to melt us. So what you get is this misunderstanding of culture, that you can't melt away culture that easily. So they rejected that model, and they have a new model now called the salad bowl, right? That's the new one, the salad bowl model. And in a salad bowl, you get all these different vegetables. You get romaine lettuce, you get Napa cabbage, you get jalapenos, you get kimchi. You get all these different vegetables, and you throw it into this big bowl. So now we've got all these wonderful flavors. Now we can taste all these different flavors in the salad bowl. But what do you do with that salad? You drench it in creamy ranch. So now, if you drench creamy ranch in enough creamy ranch in anything, it's not going to taste like that vegetable. It's going to taste like creamy ranch. So that becomes the colorblind approach. So yeah, we got all these different flavors in our church together. We got black, white, Latino, Asian, Native American. It's wonderful. But then you worship like white people have done for 200 years. And you call that the salad bowl. Yes, it's a salad bowl, but all I taste is creamy ranch. So what we're seeing is in a colorblind approach, we're seeing this kind of low view of culture, at least certain cultures, and then an elevation of particular cultures. Again, what is normative? What is the normative theology that will be taught? What is the normative form of worship that will be offered? What will be the normative style of prayer? What will be the normative approaches to ecclesiology? That becomes the issue of power. The second part of that, and how much time do I have? Oh. I'm in preaching. I've slipped into preaching mode, so you gotta catch me on my time here.
Another. We're good. Well, 4:30. Just finish.
Okay. All right. Is that all right with you?
I've lost track of time.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll speak faster.
Take your time.
Okay.
That's what I
don't speak faster. let's talk about privilege. Privilege. And the original title of this book was called "The White Captivity of the Church." And my editor said, well, let's work with that title just a little bit. We want to sell at least a handful of books, you know. Not just your friends are going to buy this book. We want some other people to buy this book. So we worked with the title, Next Evangelicals. But I did get the subtitle in there, Freeing the Church from Western Cultural Captivity. So this idea is shifting from power to privilege. And in the privilege is the expectation that when you walk into a particular setting, that the dominant culture will be your culture. Again, that's the privilege. That's white privilege. That's also the Western cultural captivity of the church. And what I mean by cultural captivity, and that phrase has been used in a lot of different ways, but what I mean by cultural captivity is that the church, and again, focusing especially on evangelicalism, the church looks more like the culture that it's a part of than the actual gospel. And if you take the gospel message or the scriptures and you compare that to the culture will win out. And this is an irony for evangelicalism, because evangelicalism is all about the scripture. We go by what the Bible tells us. But ultimately, in the Western cultural captivity of the church, Western culture is more of a determining factor of how you do church than actually the scriptures themselves. One example that I often give is this, and I give three examples: individualism, consumerism, materialism, and racism. But I want to hit on this topic of individualism. Individualism is a central mark of Western philosophy. Forget about theology, let's just talk about Western philosophy. Any strain that you see in Western philosophy is going to have a very strongly individualistic approach to it. And so when we have individualism in Western culture, if the church is caught up in captivity to Western culture, that means the way the church does ministry becomes caught up in Western culture. Two examples of this. First is how we read scripture. If you look at the scriptures, you'll find out of the 66 books, maybe two, maybe three books of the Bible written to individuals. 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon, nobody's read that anyway, but you've got these two or three books of the Bible written to individuals, whereas the overwhelming majority of these books are written to communities. The church in Corinth, the church in Thessalonica, the people of God, the nation of Israel. They're written for communities to be read by communities and to be understood in the context of community. But if you took a sampling of any typical evangelical church, what's the number one topic that you're going to see among evangelical sermons? The topic is the individual. The best sellers among evangelicals, you can be a better you. You cannot get more individualistic than you can be a better you. The purpose-driven life, for you, the individual. The prayer of Jabez, prayed for you, the individual. So these are the three of the biggest sellers that we've had in American Christian, you know, books for the last 5-10 years. They're all about how the individual can co-opt a better life for themselves. And that becomes the god or the idol that gets worshipped among evangelicals, the individual. I give this example about worship. I used to lead worship in a contemporary worship church for many years, and this is back in the day before LCD projectors. You had the overhead projector with transparencies. Anybody remember transparency boxes? And they would alphabetize them based upon the first letter of the song, except for one problem. The biggest folder was the letter I, right? You had about 100 songs. 50 of them would be in the folder marked the letter I. Now, what does this tell you about our worship? Evangelical worship is focused on the individual to the point that the I is the subject and the object of worship. You have two songs about Jesus, three songs about God, but then ultimately it is about I, or me, and that becomes the center of worship. The implication on this reconciliation is this, that the way we view scripture, the way we view worship, also slips into our understanding of sin. And our sin, perception of sin, is also extremely individualized. And this comes into play when we talk about racial reconciliation. Because in a dominant Western culture, in a dominant Western white culture, you view sin through the lens of the individual. Again, what's preached in typical evangelical churches? You know, put aside your sin and come to Jesus just as you are, as an individual, and you, individual, will find salvation for your soul. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just not a complete picture. But if you build an entire theology, soteriology, around this topic of the individual experience of salvation, then you start viewing everything in the world through that individual sin lens, individual salvation lens. So what that produces in Western culture, predominantly Western white culture, is this sense of guilt. And guilt is very individualized. You feel guilty because you did something wrong or did something bad. Now, as an Asian, I have a background that says guilt is not a complete emotion or understanding of my relationship to sin. I need to understand something called shame. I come from a shame-based culture. Let me give you some of the differences here. In a guilt-based culture, if you don't get into Harvard, you know, you've ruined your life, but you haven't ruined my life, right? So the parents say, you didn't get into Harvard, that's okay. In a shame-based culture, Asian cultures, if you didn't get into Harvard, you are a disgrace to me, you're a disgrace to your grandparents, you're a disgrace to your entire lineage. And you see this in other communities as well. If you do something wrong, it reflects badly on all of us. It reflects badly on, you don't know how many times I heard my parents say, you know, if you do something bad, all the Korean people in America will be disgraced because of you. That's a sense of shame. But there's a greater sense of collective. We're representing not just the individual, but a family, a kinship, a nation, a nationality, an ethnic group. But whereas in American society or white society, it's, well, you as an individual are making individual choices, and that's a problem. Now, when we talk about racial reconciliation and you have an individualized guilt versus the corporate shame, in an individualized guilt system, you can do away with guilt. And that's why I don't like the word white guilt. I'll rather use the word shame. White guilt is insufficient when we come to understanding racial reconciliation. Because in the concept of guilt, which is individualized, if you have white guilt, you did something wrong as an individual 10 years ago. You had a bad thought about a black person. You called somebody a bad name. So in order to do away with guilt, what do you need to do now? You need to commit a positive individual act. And that does away with a negative individual act 10 years ago. So I said a bad word. I had a bad thought. So this year I'm going to help out at a soup kitchen. This year I'm really going to take the King holiday off and maybe go to a church service. So it becomes an individualized way of dealing with racism. Because something bad happened 10 years ago that I did personally wrong, I'm going to have to do something personally right now in order to absolve myself of guilt. Now, if we see racism through that lens, then actually none of us are guilty of racism. We are all scot-free, honestly. Especially me. I'm an Asian. I have never owned a slave in my life. In fact, my people have never owned a slave in our lives because we weren't here when all of this went down. We were in Korea. So we have nothing to do with the slave problem here, right? And, you know, we never took land away from a Native American because we came here after all of that went down. It was hundreds of years later we came. And so as an Asian, I am particularly scot-free when it comes to racism if I'm looking at it from the lens of the individual lens. And that's what oftentimes I hear when we talk about racism. Well, I've never owned a slave in my life. Well, of course not. Slavery's been abolished in the United States. Yeah, you've never personally. Well, I've never taken land away from a native. Of course not. That was happening a long time ago. But that's when you're talking about an individual guilt rather than a corporate shame of the sin of racism. And the difference for me is, I raised this because I was speaking to a group of Harvard Asian American students, and I was talking about the corporate sense of shame, and they were thinking what I said earlier, Asian Americans, that's really not our history. You know, our people didn't own slaves. Our people didn't take land away from Native Americans. We need to go to the white church and tell them that. But what I said was, you are at an institution whose endowment relied a lot on slave money. You're at an institution from land taken from Native Americans. And so even though you individually are not complicit in the sin of racism, you have certainly benefited from an unjust system of racism. And that makes you complicit in the shame of racism. You might not have the guilt of individual racism, but you have the shame of corporate racism. And so when we talk about this reconciliation, I think we do a disservice when we limit our understanding of racism and reconciliation to a concept of individualized guilt without understanding this fuller concept of a corporate shame for the sin of racism. Well, in the last 5 minutes, I spend a lot of time deconstructing. And I share with my students that I was a pastor for almost 17 years, 10 years at one particular church, but over the course of my life, I was a pastor for 17 years. In fact, this past year, starting June, was the first time that I've not been called pastor, and it still feels weird to me. I still, you know, spiritually, I don't know how to deal with not being called pastor after 17 years of being a pastor. But one of the things that I recognize when I shift from pastor to professor was that professors are really good at deconstructing. That's our job, right? I mean, we spend a lot of our time nuancing texts and taking things apart. That we're really good at deconstructing problems and saying, this is the problem. That becomes our work. What I found is that as a professor now, I'm less good at constructing answers or dealing in a constructive way. Now, I think I was doing that as a pastor because I was living it. I was living out a beloved community. I was living out an attempt to build a multi-ethnic church. I was living out an attempt to live the models of reconciliation, relocation, redistribution. I was trying to live it out. And so even if we were making mistakes, at least we were constructing something. And I found that in the last 2.5 years, steeped more in the academic world, it's a lot easier for me to deconstruct than it is for me to construct. But let me try to end with some construction rather than closing with a negative note of deconstruction. And I think Professor Marsh's book is the way to put it. The idea of that King proposed of we need to develop beloved communities. And I want to approach that from another angle by one of my favorite theologians, Brueggemann, who in his book Shalom talks about the difference between the theology of the haves and the theology of the have-nots. The way he would nuance that would be, say, one group is a theology of celebration, and the other group is a theology of suffering. And if you're in the theology of celebration, and what he says is that if you look at this idea of shalom or even justice, those in the theology of celebration are going to have a different angle on shalom and justice than those who are in the theology of suffering. So the Hebrew word shalom, and we've talked about this a little bit with the idea of peace. Peace in the Hebrew word is not the absence of conflict. Again, that's kind of it does this service when we talk about racial reconciliation and say, we want peace, racial peace. Well, the Western concept of peace is when there is no war, that's peace. That's not the Hebrew concept. That's not the biblical concept of peace. The biblical concept of peace is the fullness and wholeness of God. So we can say we have earthly peace without having shalom. And so what I would say is we're moving not towards an earthly peace, the cessation of conflict, the absence of war, absence of conflict. We need to move towards a biblical shalom. Now, that's a different story. Because if you have a biblical shalom and you're coming from the theology of celebration, you're going to look at shalom or the fullness and wholeness of God very different from if you're coming from the theology of suffering. If you're coming from the theology of celebration, the world is generally good. Why? Because you've got good things. You've got... You know, you've got your nice house, you've got 2.5 children, you've got your German engineered car with butt warmers, you've got all the good things. What else do you need? You've got the good things. Life as a whole is already whole, healthy, generally good. God, therefore, takes on the persona of a nurturer, almost a feminine figure, because that nurturer is going to help you maintain and steward what you have. And what you want to do from the theology of celebration, because you already have good things, is maintain the status quo. But if you're from the theology of suffering, the world is actually not a good place. The world is an evil place. Life is precarious. You need a deliverer, not someone who's going to nurture you and steward your good things. If you don't have good things, you need God to come and smite all his enemies. That's why the Psalms are so interesting, because you have both of those. You have some in the Psalms talk about living under the shadow of God's wings, very nurturing image of God kind of taking care of you. And that's the theology of celebration. You've got good things. You want God to nurture you. But then you get, Lord, come and smite all my enemies. That's the theology of suffering, because the world is a bad place and it's an evil place, and you want God to take care of business. So in that case, in the theology of suffering, God is a warrior, a masculine figure, and God needs to fight injustice rather than maintain the status quo. Let me illustrate this by talking about two different views of heaven, or shalom. Let's go to Barrington, Illinois, or actually Winnetka, Illinois, or Charlottesville, for that matter. Let's go to an affluent, predominantly white, upper middle class community. And you go to that community and you ask a 16-year-old girl at a local church, hey, what's heaven like to you? What do you think heaven's going to be like? And she says, oh, heaven's going to be wonderful. Heaven's going to be wonderful because on earth, my parents gave me this dinky little Japanese car to drive around in. But when I get to heaven, I'm getting a Ferrari. On earth, I have this small 19-inch TV with just rabbit ears in my bedroom. But on heaven, I'm going to get a 65-inch plasma with satellite hookup. On earth, I've got this, you know, little Dell desktop computer that I got at Costco. But when I get to heaven, I'm going to get a Mac AirBook. So heaven, to a 16-year-old already living in affluence with good things, is more like earth. And that makes sense, because she already has all these good things on earth. However, if you ask that same question to a 16-year-old girl in Darfur, Sudan, what do you think her answer is going to be? Heaven is nothing like earth. Heaven is a place that I don't have to fight for every drop of water, every scrap of food. Heaven is a place where I won't be raped. Heaven is a place where my parents aren't dead. Heaven is a place where I don't feel terror. Heaven is nothing like what earth is right now. Now, the fact is, both of them are correct. But one is coming out of the understanding of shalom, heaven, justice, from the angle of celebration, and the other is coming out of the angle of suffering. Both have a picture of heaven. And again, both are not incorrect. They're just incomplete pictures. And in fact, the two need to talk to one another in order to get a more complete picture of heaven. In the same way, when we talk about Christology, our Christology is incomplete unless we have a theology of suffering and a theology of celebration. Example of this. Western evangelicalism has been obsessed with the crucifixion and the atonement theory. In fact, in the UK, the evangelical groups split because one evangelical group said, well, we got to talk about the atonement this way. The other said, we got to talk about it this way. And same thing here in the United States. People are calling each other heretics because of a particular perspective on atonement. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying the atonement is unimportant. It is important. But it's interesting to me how in the West, theology of celebration, there is an over-obsessiveness about one particular aspect out of many aspects of Christology. And it focuses on the suffering aspect of Christology. Why? Because we in the West, we have so much celebration, we want to understand suffering. That's the missing part of our doctrine. We don't experience suffering, therefore that's the thing we need to understand better. However, if you go to other parts of the world, let's take Latin America for example, you've got people already in suffering. They know the crucifixion. They know the cross. They're living it every day. So what is their desire to understand? The triumphant return and the power of the resurrection. And it comes out through liberation theology, a theology of the Holy Spirit, a theology of a triumphant kingdom. That's because that in the experience of Latin America, you have this real deep experience of the cross. But there is a desire to understand more than that. The best example of this for me was when I was I've been privileged and blessed to be asked to speak of black churches for many, many times. But the first time I was ever asked to preach at a black church, I was very nervous. And I said, I don't know how I'm going to pull this off. I don't know what I'm going to do. So I went to one of my mentors, an African-American woman. I said, how do I do this thing? How do you preach at a black church? And she gave me one piece of advice that I've always adhered to. When you preach at a black church, don't you ever stop at the cross. You got to get to the resurrection. Don't stop preaching at the cross. We already know about the cross. You can preach the cross, but don't stop there. Make sure you get to the power of the resurrection. Again, in the African-American community, there's already this experience of the cross. There's already this experience of the suffering. There's a longing to know the other part of it, which is the celebration. I raise this because when it comes to constructing a reconciliation model, this is where we need to start talking about we need each other rather than one side needing the other. Now, I've read enough urban ministry books to know the typical format of urban ministry books. It is an enlightened white male who has decided that he's going to tear off the shackles of his privilege and power and move into an urban community and help those poor black people. I've read too many books like that. I don't need another book like that. But it's the books they keep pointing out of these Christian publishing companies, the wealthy white males who has decided to shake off the privilege and move into the poor black neighborhood. Well, what that tells us is that there is a bias towards the theology of celebration. And we're not hearing the story of the theology that emerges out of suffering. We have an incomplete Christology. We have an incomplete ecclesiology in evangelicalism. I'll stop there because I can get rolling and we'll... Thank you.